So Brooks Richards, Real 10.
I shall never forget coming out from the Mersingham officer's mess after lunch and seeing Douglas Dodds Parker in a state of great excitement, because a stick of parachute trainees was being dropped. They were OSS trainees, and they were being dropped right across the aerial farm of the Mersingham radio station. And the situation was diplomatically tricky, to the extent that I remember Douglas's first reflex, though he probably wouldn't admit it now, was that here are the Americans trying to sabotage this negotiation by destroying our aerials. Nothing of the sort, in fact, occurred. I mean, these people had obviously been carried by the wind away from where they'd intended to drop in the dunes. But it was a rather amusing moment in retrospect. Well, the Italian negotiation came to fruition, and Italy became co-belligerent. And at that stage, the problem arose of leapfrogging part of SOE's resources forward for to establish them in Italy itself. The first time that SOE had an opportunity of operating on former enemy territory. And the man selected for this job was Jerry Holdsworth, my boss, who was at the time a lieutenant commander, RNVR, and he started collecting his team, and in due course he crossed to Italy on a rather foul-smelling boat which my brother Robin, who had been in the Mediterranean for several months already from Helford, had a boat that he'd requisitioned somewhere in Sicily, I think, for ferrying weapons, captured weapons from Tunisia to across to the Adriatic for use by the partisans in Yugoslavia, the Gilfrido. And anyway, Jerry Holdsworth and Peter Murray Lee, who's still alive, Jerry is not, Peter has recorded for the IWM, were embarked, Peter as security officer of the little embryo Maryland mission. And they sailed off and landed at Monopoly, at the southern end of the Adriatic, and set about creating the essentials for conducting irregular guerrilla warfare in Italy, should opportunity occur. And, of course, it did occur on a big scale, and the training camps and radio facilities and so on that they created in due course served to supply and direct the efforts of 100,000 partisans in northern Italy, a rather unusual command for Jerry, even though he became a full commander, RNVR, by the time that occurred. But I was, of course, left in Algiers, the intention being that I would go up to Corsica, to Bastia, immediately on the liberation of Corsica, which was just imminent, and would open a base for conducting maritime operations into northern Italy and southern France, taking with me the Helford crews, boat crews and so on that we'd got, and one at least of our fishing boats to serve as depot. And I was looking forward to this job, but just at that point, quite different situation required solution, because de Gaulle had come out on top in the power struggle amongst the French in Algiers, which had he'd been confronted with Giraud, and finally he'd worn Giraud down. And after moments when he was so in despair that he'd thought of throwing his own hand in, and Harold Millen has recorded in his Mediterranean Diaries, which have now been published, very interestingly, the efforts he had to deploy to keep de Gaulle running, because of course the Americans still had so little love of de Gaulle that they would have been absolutely delighted if he'd opted out. Roosevelt came very slowly to recognize that de Gaulle had got to be recognized as an important force. And anyhow, one of the consequences of de Gaulle emerging on top was that we had briefly two lots of French secret services operating out of Algiers. They were still under a French general called Ronin, R-O-N-I-N, Giraud's deuxième bureau in the Palais d'Été, and there was under Jacques Soustelle, a young anthropologist from the Musée de l'Homme in Paris, the Free French equivalent, which in London was termed the BCRA, the Bureau Central du Renseignement et de l'Action, but in Algiers it was termed the Direction Générale des Services Spéciaux, DGSS, because this was where the Committee of National Liberation sat, and that was supposed to be the imparting direction to the London operation as well as to what went on from Algiers. Well, the Massingham French country section had been run by a very delightful and gallant fellow called Jacques de Guelis, G-U-E-L-I-S, of whom particulars can be found in Michael Foote's book, because he previously made a mission for SOE's French section into France. They've gone on one mission into France before being sent to Algiers to set up this operation, which had been masterminding the whole of the Corsica operation with Colonna d'Istria. Well, Jacques de Guelis was ably seconded by his cousin, Val Barbier, who they had grown up in South Wales, had I think, a French grandfather, possibly even a French father, but Jacques' background, without checking, I'm not too sure whether he how he came to be in British uniform, but I think Martinique or Réunion was involved in it in some way. Anyhow, the two of them plus a training officer, Robert Searle, constituted the essential part of that section, plus some very able girls, secretaries and so on. And at this point, de Gaulle made it perfectly clear he was not going to deal with Jacques de Guelis, because Jacques not only belonged to the Buckmaster section by background, but he'd also been recruiting with the help of friendly officers in North Africa, people who were sent home for training by the Buckmaster section and putting into France. And of course, whereas de Gaulle in London couldn't stop us doing this. Training and putting into France people of our own choice. It was another matter in French North Africa, which was still theoretically under French sovereignty. And he dug his heels in, and Jacques de Gaulis had to go. So we were confronted at short, well, SOE was confronted at short notice with the need to find a new section head for the Massingham French section. And Robin Brooke, still alive today, Sir Robin Brooke, who's been a merchant banker most of his life, was had started as advisor to Dr. Dalton when he was Minister of Economic Warfare, and had become the regional director for the whole of Western Europe for SOE, came out to look at this problem on the ground, and he hit on me as somebody put in the job, so I was asked if I would go into it. Well, I was rather sad to be taking a desk job, but there didn't really seem to be any easily available alternative, and I agreed that I would do it and have a try at doing it. So I was put in, and since it proved possible to find an absolutely admirable replacement to take the place that I would have had in heading the party sent on to Corsica, and the person there concerned was Andrew Croft, at that time I think a major, subsequently a colonel, who had been before the war in Greenland with Janet Watkins. This is all set out in Michael Foote's book, and had been with Gubbins in Norway, and had been assistant military attaché in Stockholm before coming out to North Africa, and he had been doing boat training for the Bataillon de Choc at the Club des Pins, and he was very good in a canoe anyhow, or a small boat, and a great perfectionist in operational detail, so that though he was a soldier, his qualifications for the job in Corsica were admirable, and so I found myself in the country section, and he going off to Corsica with John Newton and an American OSS officer called Fisher Howe, who a naval officer who had been sent to see really how we worked, and before they sailed, Andrew came to see me, and he said, "I can't get on with this fellow Fisher Howe." And Fisher Howe came to me and said, "I can't get on with Andrew Croft." And I sent them off, notwithstanding this, and they became closest possible friends. It worked very well. Fisher didn't stay for many weeks in Corsica, and he was wanted back in their London headquarters. But Andrew set up what became an extremely important facility for landing people in on the western, northwestern coast of Italy and southeastern coast of France from Bastia, using the available British and American gunboats that were up there, and this was all organized under the general coordination of Slocum's section, Deputy Director of Operations Division, Rackets I. He had somebody called Pat Winnie as his man out there. There was a joint intelligence room set up for all the people who needed this type of landing arrangement. covering all the relevant areas under somebody called Paddy Davis, who's still alive, and who was recruited from... what was termed 30 Commando at the time, or 30 Assault Group. It was, in fact, striking arm of Naval Intelligence Department for going ashore with, or going into places with advanced troops in order to seize what was of importance in connection with naval intelligence. Davis left them to run the operations room and a common intelligence facility for all users in Bastia, which he did with great success. And Andrew Croft carried out a total, well, I think 38 successful missions out of approximately 50 attempted from Bastia, including landing agents right inside the boom in Genoa Harbour. He found a place with a German guard post on a quay, and he went deliberately close into this for successive landing operations after rowing in across the boom. And he said, well, he liked the place because the Germans there felt able to smoke at night, and you could always see where they were, or nearly always see where they were. At any rate, he collected a very well-earned DSO out of that run of operations and served both the Maryland mission dealing with Italy and my French country section who were putting people into southeastern France. And Andrew is still very much alive as the trustee of the Special Forces Club, and after the war served not only as the war officer's expert on polar warfare for quite a long time and taught the Americans a great deal about it, but then became commandant of the police college at Hendon. Well, my Algiers job began to gather momentum during the winter 43-44 with when the prospect of a landing in the southeastern France was first mooted. And this was a project that was not beloved of Churchill. He did what he could to try and stop it, because he knew that it would have to be carried out with a substantial diversion of forces from the campaign in Italy. And he didn't want to rob Field Marshal Alexander of what it, who was having a hard slog after Anzio, capture of Rome and so on, had been quite difficult. The Allies got bogged down at Anzio. And the thought of bogging him down once again by taking forces away from landing in the south of France was very unwelcome as far as Churchill was concerned. But the French really proved the decisive factor, because de Gaulle made it absolutely clear that it was not going to be acceptable for French forces to be employed in Italy at a time when they might be employed in liberating metropolitan France, and that he was going to take Dalat's army corps away from the Italian front anyway. And I think this swung the argument. The Americans were quite keen on the landing in the south of France to open that up and help the breakout for the Normandy beachhead. But it wasn't till surprisingly late that the plan was definitely decided on, something like July, I think, 1944, a month after the landings in Normandy. But We'd been preparing ourselves to increase our effort on southern France, putting more people in, and then with this possibility, still uncertain, of a landing in the south of France, the question of exactly how we would articulate command and signals and so on with Algiers became a major issue. Before I go into that, I ought perhaps to say that after we'd started working with the DGSS, there still was a rump of Giraud's former deuxième bureau left behind, and Giraud got us to put an agent into southern France, a nice young man called Sobra, S-O-B-R-A, lieutenant, to try and rally the Armistice Army onto his side. And we dropped Sobra in, and a month later General Renan, wringing his hands, said they wanted to do it again, put somebody else in. And I had to tell him at that point, I'm frankly sorry, we now cannot conceivably deal with two different French secret services on this kind of thing. And so Giraud's last hope of running agents into France disappeared at that point. Well, the as good luck would have it, the DGSS, the Free French Secret Service, detailed off as the officer to keep an eye on all their trainees at the Club des Pins and to escort them and see them off when going into the field, a chap called Guillaume Widmer, W-I-D-M-E-R, who was at the time a lieutenant of the Infanterie Coloniale. He'd been in peacetime. He'd been working in the Banque d'Indochine in Shanghai. And he was French Protestant by background. He was cousin of Henri Gide. And in Shanghai, he'd become, he'd made a lot of British friends. He was a very keen horseman and a prominent member of the Gymkhana Club in Shanghai. And he'd got used to the international atmosphere of Shanghai, and it had detribalized him to a considerable extent, whereas British, French, and Americans in North Africa still walked around very much in their own native traditions. Widmer was happily easy to deal with and get on with, and he and I became really very close friends quite quickly. He'd got back to France by stages. He'd been in fighting, he'd been mobilized and been in Indochina when the Japanese took that over. He was repatriated to France and went to friends in Provence and finally came out through Spain. With great good fortune, we got him in this job. And he's a very shrewd judge of character on the whole, picking the right people to go into France and keeping an eye on them during training. But he was a man of great imagination and breadth of view. And though his rank was fairly lowly at the time, only a year later, he had become, do I exaggerate? Hardly more than a year later, at any rate, he'd become governor of Württemberg-Hohenzollern in the French colonial occupation in Germany with the assimilated rank of lieutenant general. And he and I were sent off to London on a mission, I think, that we'd partly devised ourselves in February 1944 to talk to SOE and the BCRA in London and agree with them exactly how we would build up a pattern of alternative communications direct to Algiers in preparation for a possible southern landing. And to sort out practical problems affecting air supply at the time, because the pattern of air supply to France had become quite complicated, in that the main available special duties supply squadron strength was still at Thamesford in England, 138 and 161 squadrons, equipped with Halifaxes, and but they had found it convenient very often after being sent on a mission from Thamesford in Bedfordshire to carry on south and to land in Algiers rather than return at their home base directly. And we worked out an arrangement whereby, since there were frequently all differences of weather north and south of Lyon, so that weather might be bad up there but perfectly balmy in the Alps and the Massif Central south of that meteorological divide. And therefore, an aircraft frequently would go off expecting to drop somewhere in northern France, not able to find a reception committee, would carry on south and would find decent weather, and we would have arranged, we worked out a system whereby we arranged an alternative reception point down there in the southern zone, onto which the cargo that hadn't been able to be delivered in the north, frequently because of cloud cover, was dropped there. So the aircraft came on to Algiers, we reloaded it, it did the reverse process the following night, flying back to England right across occupied France. And so there was considerable de facto integration of air supply operations between North Africa and the United Kingdom by the beginning of 1944. And we decided we would build on this, and would we were able to do so with a very good effect. The journey of Wiedemeyer and I made to London proved a rather lengthy one. To start off with, air transport was very slow and uncertain at the time. Even with priority one, you frequently would find yourself taking many days to get back to London because